Next is Dr. Van Essen, and he will talk on the development of human cerebral cortex in health and disease.
So there are many fascinating aspects of development. First, I disclose I have no disclosures to make. And in the substance of the talk, I want to cover three main areas, more about prenatal cortical development. You've heard some important starting points from the previous talk. Then we'll talk more about postnatal maturation. Then I want to add some context from emerging information coming from the Human Connectome Project, studying adult brain connectivity, but with aspirations to look at developmental issues. So we'll be using the macaque monkey as well as humans directly, and it's useful to make some initial comparisons. A macaque has a cerebral cortex that's about cookie size for each hemisphere, and it's very thin. Human cortex is about a 13-inch pizza per cerebral hemisphere, slightly thicker. The patterns of convolutions are stereotyped in the macaque and highly variable, as we'll come back to, in humans. We can subdivide the cerebral cortical sheet into a mosaic of many different cortical areas. This is an extremely challenging but important problem. A progress report is there's evidence for well over 100 cortical areas in the macaque and probably closer to 200 areas when we finally get things sorted out in the human cortex. Importantly, these aren't all pepperoni-sized parcels in our brains. The size range literally ranges over two orders of magnitude from some of the tiny little areas in frontal cortex to the very large primary visual cortex in the occipital lobe. The connectivity is extraordinarily complex, far more complex we now know than had been appreciated 10 or 20 years ago. The lower right shows a connectivity matrix that is essentially evidence for thousands of connections that have been demonstrated anatomically in the macaque, and we have every reason to believe it's even more complex in our brains. The issue of cortical convolutions I will now return to. Here are six right hemispheres of different individuals on the upper row and inflated versions of those same hemispheres in the lower panels. Some regions, like the arrows pointing to the central sulcus, show consistent patterns of folding across all individuals. Other regions, such as the junction between temporal parietal and occipital cortex, are highly variable. It's almost as though they're quasi-randomly crumpled to get it packaged in. And that raises the question of why, and our fascination with this is enhanced by the observation that even in identical twins, genetically identical twins, the folding patterns from one twin to another are as different, almost as different, as they are between unrelated individuals. So there is some heritability of cortical convolutions, but the most striking thing is how variable it is despite the same starting instruction kit. So a few key issues I want to touch upon. Why is the cortex a sheet? Why does it fold? And why is it so variable? There are hugely important questions that we don't have time and don't have answers to as to how the cortical parcellations arise and how is this exquisite specificity of connections established. But to focus on the issue of cortical shape, morphogenesis is essentially a process that's driven by the issues that we heard about from Candace: cell proliferation, migration, and differentiation. And it's the physical forces within the brain that determine its shape. So here you see a coronal slice through a very early stage of brain development. You can see the lower arrow is pointing to blob-like structures that will become the basal ganglia. The upper arrow is pointing to the sheet-like cerebral cortex that surrounds the ventricles. And what is striking about these two regions is that the cellular architecture is very different. In the cerebral cortex, we know that even from the very earliest stages, neurons extend dendrites, apical dendrites that run radially from the inner to the outer extent. And it's known from other studies that neuronal processes, both dendrites and axons, generate mechanical tension. So how might that play out? The idea that I had almost two decades ago is that in blob-like structures like those that become subcortical nuclei, the cells don't have this radial organization. Their dendrites are spraying out in all directions, and so there's no anisotropic force generation. But in contrast, the radial organization of the apical dendrites provides a mechanism to pull the cortical sheet and make it thin and to force the expansion to occur along the tangential direction. So that's a hypothesis that has explanatory power. It's not proven, but it's an attractive way of thinking how sheet-like structures can be generated through the architecture of their constituent neurons. Let's turn to the issue of cortical folding. It occurs in the third trimester, as you can see in the surface reconstructions in the lower drawing from work by Jason Hill and Terry Inder and Jeff Neal. And during that period of cortical folding, you can also see that the white matter is expanding dramatically. Another light bulb moment for me relating to this idea of mechanical tension is that starts with the point that in monkeys and presumably in ourselves as well, the two of the largest cortical areas are the primary and secondary visual cortex, V1 and V2 over in the right. They start out initially as part of a smooth, unfolded sheet, but when the cortex starts to fold, it brings V1 and V2 closer together, and that's related to the fact that there are massive connections between V1 and V2 in both directions that are point-to-point representations of the visual field or retinotopic map. So the idea, extending on this mechanical tension hypothesis, if axons as well as dendrites are generating tension, as they do in tissue culture, then long-distance tugging between strongly connected regions could form a gyrus in between and make the wiring length shorter, and a sulcus would be essentially a loser in that battle. It would have fewer connections and allow a fold that makes those axons a little bit longer. So that's an attractive idea because it can explain not only the consistency of connections in regions that are dominated by massive pathways, but the variability may reflect a competition between little balkanized areas where the outcome is different from one individual to the next. Is that the whole story? Probably not. There are other mechanisms that have been proposed, buckling by differential laminar growth, the fact that the skull forms a mechanical barrier to brain expansion, and an intriguing set of observations from the Kriegstein and other labs that within the developing germinal layers, that there's a domain called the subventricular zone where there is differential proliferation that has been proposed to contribute to gyral and sulcal formation. So to wrap it up, in biology, multiple mechanisms are common, and I think it's very attractive to think that a combination of differential proliferation and tension-based folding drive the outcomes that we see in the highly diverse cortical sheet, especially in humans. Let's move on to postnatal occurrences. An infant's brain has much of the shape of an adult. Most of the convolutions are present and well accounted for, but there's a threefold overall expansion between birth and adulthood, as shown on the left. And when Jason Hill measured the relative expansion in different regions of the cortex, he came to a striking observation, namely that regions shown in orange and yellow in lateral, temporal, and parietal cortex are zones of differential expansion, overexpansion, whereas the regions in blue, including the primary sensory areas and insular cortex, are regions of relatively low or underexpansion. All regions expand, but some more than others. And that can be seen in individual subjects. If you look on the right panels, the far right column is an adult lateral temporal cortex, and in the left-hand column there, a newborn infant has cortical folds. They just don't look as mature. And so that's confirmation of the statistically significant pattern shown in the middle panels. This has been confirmed by studies by the North Carolina group. You'll hear more about that from John Gilmore in some beautiful studies looking at early development, these patterns are similar, but they're not identical, and that's an intriguing question that deserves follow-up to see whether there are methodological differences or neurobiological patterns that the expansion may occur more in lateral temporal cortex in late stages of maturation. So that's an open question. But in the meantime, let's move on to a different issue, the issue of myelination that you heard about from Candace. We have a way to explore that in the living brain using imaging. So if we look at a horizontal slice high in the brain with a T1 weighted image, we can see that the gray matter is uniform. It's gray throughout, but there are some regions that are a little bit lighter and others that are darker. And if we take a T2 weighted image, so the same brain slice but a complementary kind of imaging, we see some regions that are darker, others that are brighter. And if we take the ratio of these two values at every voxel and just take that ratio and colorize it, we get a colorful map in one brain slice, and we can map that to the cortical surface, and we see what is we call a myelin map that shows heavily myelinated regions in red and yellow and lightly myelinated regions in blue and indigo. And it turns out that the pattern of heavy myelination was discovered by Flexig almost a century ago, and those two patterns correlate, that myelination that's heavy in the adult occurs earlier in developing an infant brain. It turns out these patterns of myelin heavy and light are correlated, that the regions that I showed you are zones of early of postnatal expansion, are also regions that are expanded greatly in human cortex compared to macaque monkeys, and they are the regions that are lightly myelinated in adults. And these are also the regions that we think of that are most heavily involved in higher cognitive functions in our brains. And there's also differences in cortical thickness. I think even more intriguingly, there are differences at a cellular level. The regions that are lightly myelinated and expand most during postnatal development also have larger neurons, or essentially computer chips that are have more processing power, and that expansion of dendritic arbors occurs postnatally, and it's also correlated with regional differences in the total density of neurons. So while the cortical sheet is uniform in many ways, there are fascinating and very important differences at a cellular and macroscopic level that are relevant to thinking about healthy brains as well as adult brains. So to move on to the issue of development that's not quite so normal, if we take preterm infants and ask how their brains look when they, after the premature birth, but scanned at the term equivalent, 38 to 40 weeks, one sees that in these infants, some of them look pretty normal, but as shown on the lower two panels, some of them look distinctly abnormal, especially in lateral temporal cortex. And when the Terry Enders group, Aaron Engelhardt et al., looked at this more quantitatively, we found evidence that there's actually indications of selective vulnerability of cortical maturation, especially in lateral temporal cortex. So it contributes to the picture that the brain and the cerebral cortex is not uniform in its healthy adult characteristics, and it is selectively vulnerable in ways that are relevant to thinking about diseases and disorders. So lastly, and very briefly, the Human Connectome Project is towards the tail end of a 5-year project to study 1,200 healthy adults studying twins and their siblings using cutting-edge imaging methods, and coupling that with extensive behavioral testing, so we get a lot about the actual cognitive and personality phenotype of the individuals. We'll next year do genetic genotyping on all these subjects, and we're already making this data freely available to the entire neuroscience community. Just to give you a teaser of what one can see with this multimodal approach, you see on the left a map of one individual's folding pattern. In the middle, the second column is a myelin map. The third column is a map of functional connectivity of a hotspot of myelination. And the fourth column shows you how we can map functional MRI task activations in the same subjects. We can do this in all subjects. And when we want to do that, we find there's a lot of individual variability, but we can bring that individual variability into alignment using sophisticated methods of alignment of the cortical surfaces, what we call multimodal surface matching, and that's adding a lot of power to our ability to explore not only commonalities but differences across individuals. So in summary, we've taken a quick look at prenatal development, postnatal maturation, sensitivity to perturbation and injury, and an exploration of human brain circuits. So I thank the team that's involved in the human development studies and a wonderful group of investigators in the Human Connectome Project. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you, David. That was fantastic. We have time for a couple questions, and if people could please use the microphones in the aisles there for asking these. I have one to start off with. Dave, do you think that there's an evolutionary advantage for the greater rate of postnatal cortical expansion for the brain areas that will become those serving higher brain functions?
I hope so. I think, you know, childhood education is all about getting wiring to change to encode what we learn, and these regions that are delayed in their expansion, I believe, is likely to reflect the preservation of plasticity and the ability to not only lose synapses but to grow new synapses to, in combination, lead to what we call learning.
Yeah, Jeff Vance, Miami. Lissencephaly. The lack of sulci and convulsions.
Lissencephaly?
Yeah, Lissencephaly. Yeah. There is a genetic component to that. How does that work into your idea of mechanical tension?
So some types of Lissencephaly involve abnormal migration, a failure of neurons to migrate all the way out to their cortical layers. And I don't think it's understood what's going on, but my mechanistic hypothesis is that there's also a lack of extension of radial dendrites, and so the cortex becomes much thicker. And if it's much thicker, then the same number of neurons devote their expansion to becoming thicker rather than greater surface area. And so the failure to fold may reflect a perturbation of the cellular architecture that underlies the early development that I talked about. So that's a hypothesis, certainly not established, but a framework for thinking about it.
Other questions?
When you talked about the differences, differences in the sulcal depth with the abnormal brain, is that tied to particular diagnosis, or do you know what that might cause?
The question is whether the abnormalities in cortical folding and sulcal depth have been successfully correlated with behavioral or developmental outcomes. It's a fascinating question, an important one, and still a work in progress. So unfortunately, we don't. I strongly suspect there will be correlates, but it's likely to be rather complicated because there are often infarcts in the white matter and complex perturbations of cortical circuits. So teasing this apart is going to be an important but a hard challenge.
I have one last question. Are the methods being developed with the Human Connectome Project going to be applicable to studies of infants and very young children?
We sure hope so. There's already some pilot studying going on with our Washington University in Minnesota consortium to look at different stages of development and aging, including children as young as 4 to 6 years. There's also a very important project, colloquially known as the Baby Connectome Project, led by the group in England at UC London and Oxford to look at prenatal and early postnatal maturation. So there are a number of efforts that are underway, and they're all using as much as possible these advances in acquiring the best possible data and analyzing it in a variety of ways that give more bang for the buck.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Van Essen.